can't change one area of your life and not think it's going to affect somewhere else. That's what so many people do. They contain and control one area of their life because they believe it's going to make them feel better, without realizing that it actually has real lasting and negative impact.
This is Running for Real, the podcast for runners who know that for every runner's high, there are just as many lows. All those just missed PRs, easy runs that feel hard, injury blues, and more. Each week, we'll talk to running, health, and wellness experts about their highs, lows, and best advice to build our confidence. Running for Real is about being honest, being brave, and most of all, not feeling alone. And now here's our host, who wants to meet Breen Brown, Tina Muir.
Hello, my friends. Welcome to Running for Real, episode 99. We're at 99. That means next week is episode 100, and I could not be more excited to share this episode with you. I'm going to tell you more about that later in the show, but let's focus on episode 99 for now. Starting with last week, we had one of the best coaches out there, Steve Magnus, and he was on the show to teach us how we can run by feel. Yes, even those of you who feel you have to look at your watch or you'll go out too fast or too slow. He also gave us inside training tips. We talked about smart work over hard work and how we're in this culture where we feel that more is better rather than seeing it as, you know, better or quality is better. So we talked about that, and we also talked about his decision to be the whistleblower on the Nike Oregon project. And, you know, I'd love to hear your thoughts on that topic, as that's something obviously that is affecting the future of our sport. Now today I have a return guest who I love so much. Renee McGregor is a sports dietitian who has just been all over the media lately with her wisdom and her knowledge that people have finally realized how important this is to talk about. Now our culture has an obsession with diets, be it good or bad. And Renee is one of the people leading the charge to make it sustainable for us. And actually, enjoyable. We should be able to enjoy our food, right? I've had her on the show before, and you'll hear a little about that one today. But if you missed it, be sure to go back and check it out. But I wanted to talk about the topics that are relevant to this time of year and how we've changed since 2017, because we have. Part of this episode is focused on under-eating and how you can make sure you're eating enough for your training and for your life. But we also dive deeper than we did in previous conversations. Now, before I get to this episode, I just want to remind you that my book on overcoming amenorrhea is out in the world, and I am so excited to see the reviews coming in on Amazon and how many of you are actually enjoying it. Those photos you put up with you holding my book, oh my God, it makes my heart like want to explode. I'm so excited and happy to see that. I'm really proud of this book, and it contains my story, my journey in more detail than I've ever shared before. The second half of the book is about what I recommend to get your period back if you've missed a few or many years in my case. If this is you, this book is exactly what you're going to need during this recovery time. It isn't easy, I'm not going to lie, and you know that, but this is going to help. But if you're not a female or you have your period regularly, you still may enjoy this book for the deep dive into my story and also the message behind it that you are enough, my friend. And especially that your body is enough. You know, we beat our bodies up and we, you know, expect so much from them. But really, this book, a lot of it is about just kind of finding who you are outside of being a runner. And a lot of it comes down to finding who you are, you know, no matter what you look like. If you'd like to get yourself a copy to support me, you can search my name on Amazon and find it there. Or you can go to tinamuir.com/book. That's tinamuir.com/book. Thank you so much for being on this journey with me. I appreciate you so much. Let's go meet Renee. Renee, I am so excited to have you back on the Running for Real podcast. Thank you so much for joining me. This is going to be really exciting to talk, and I just always love talking to you. We always have these wonderful conversations, whether it's on air or off air, and this is going to be fun. So thank you for giving us some time today.
Oh, thank you for having me. I love chatting to you as well, so it's all good.
And I have, so with that, you know, I said we've been talking on air and off air, but since I last had you on in November 2017, a lot has changed for you. You've been all over many major publications and on the TV and things like that. ITV and BBC, for those who know what that is. I think everyone should know what the BBC is, but ITV is the other major channel in the UK. And you've just been doing a lot. So maybe I'd love to hear kind of what you have been up to, what 2018 looked for you, because again, it was 2017 and your episode is one I refer back to a lot, but a lot has changed since then. So tell us what you've been up to.
Yeah, no, it's been a very big 15 months, I guess. Mm-hmm. And they have been a bit of a whirlwind, really. And I wasn't really expecting to be really where I am now and doing all the things that you've just described. But mm-hmm. I think the whole kind of conversation around orthorexia has just started up. I suppose something new in that while people have always been aware of eating disorders, you know, people understand what anorexia is and bulimia, but nobody's this kind of whole hashtag clean eating, this obsession with eating purely and sort of the links, particularly with athletes. And I think more and more athletes, especially like since you spoke about your, you know, your issues and where you've come from in your journey, I think more and more athletes are coming out and talking very openly about the fact that they've had problems and what it's done for them. And so it's a very, very topical conversation. And I guess I've never been fearful of talking out about things mm-hmm. that need to be talked about. And yeah, so I think one of the first things that happened to me was I got asked to join the International Task Force for orthorexia, which I suppose started everything, because then this last March I went to Rome and presented with the task force, which was like a huge thing for me to do. I was really honoured, and they invited me as the expert in orthorexia from the UK, which was quite scary and quite daunting to kind of represent the whole of the United Kingdom. Yeah. But apparently I did a good job, so that was all good. And these is a really nice group of people. Like there's about 12 to 15 of us, and we're all from around the world. And some are academics and some are clinicians and practitioners like myself. And we meet once a year and we do kind of intermittently have Skype conferences because obviously we're all over the world. And we're looking towards how we can finally make orthorexia a diagnosable condition so that, again, it will fit in with the DSM-5 like anorexia and bulimia, so that, you know, physicians particularly can use it as a means of tick boxing and actually manage to help somebody diagnose it. But it is really complicated because, as I said, I think to you before, with orthorexia, it's so easily disguisable.
Yeah.
You know, like it's a bit like exercise, it's a bit like training. It's like being a bit like an athlete. A lot of it is disguisable because while it's going well, nobody would know and nobody would even really kind of bat an eyelid, because they'd be like, well, you're just healthy, you're just an athlete, you're just doing what you need to
do. Proud of you, like, oh, well done you for getting your eating together and getting your healthy foods in. Yeah,
exactly. And I think you only really notice it when if you get injured or something happens and you can't train or you can't eat in the way you want to eat, and suddenly it creates anxiety and then basically the wheels fall off. And it's interesting, actually. I was presenting yesterday at a BASES conference, a nutrition division day. And it was a real honor to be asked to speak at that event. And we were talking about this exact thing, that often what I've noticed, particularly in my practice, is that a lot of athletes have probably had eating problems for a very long time that have been disguised and deflected onto their training. You know, like they've just kind of moved from one area of control to another area of control. And again, like I said, it's fine until something happens, which means they can't train, and then the wheels fall off and then they don't know how to deal with it. And then the restrictive behaviors come back in and all the fear and anxiety kind of, you know, floods them and they get really, really uncomfortable. And so I think it's just something to be very, very aware of. So going back to the task force, we're hoping that we will, we'll come up with some criteria fairly soon. We've been reviewing, so a lot of the group have been doing papers for a long time over the last year. And what happens is they send out the papers, the studies as papers to the group, and we spend some time reviewing those papers. And then if they're accepted, then that's kind of, you know, bit more evidence to add to what we think orthorexia is and how we can diagnose it. So it's been really interesting. It's been a really new area for me to kind of be involved in that, and I've really loved it. Like, it's nice to meet some people that are working in the same field, and you know, the conversations are, you can imagine, really quite quite interesting and very technical, which again I love. So that's all been really good, and I guess from there on in, I've just been doing a lot more podcasts. I mean, I think the podcast I did with you kind of started everything off, and then suddenly I got asked to do lots of other podcasts and my workload got really busy. And then it was last May, I think, I remember coming home. I'd been out for a dog walk and I came home and there was a phone call. I missed a phone call, and I sort of checked my phone, and there was this message from this guy, and he was rambling on about how he'd heard me on a podcast and he wanted to talk to me about something. So I contacted him, and it was Tom Fairbrother, who, for those of you who don't know, he is somebody who's quite well known in the UK now, because he works for Parkrun now, but he has been, again, very open and honest about his experience of an eating disorder as a runner, and particularly as a male runner. Like, there's a lot of stigma we know around eating disorders full stop, but particularly around males, it's even more so. So he's been very open and honest and has had quite a lot of support with that. And he contacted me saying, I heard you on a podcast. I've never heard anybody else describe an eating disorder in the way that you have, and you really hit the nail on the head, and it's exactly what I went through. And obviously I think you're equally as passionate as I am about getting the message across about how do we change this, how do we stop this, do you think we could work together? And so we had a conversation, and I was like, well, yeah, I'd love to do something. But it's one of those things that, you know, when you've already got a really busy clinic and you're trying to juggle life and work and you're in demand doing different conferences, I was thinking, I just don't know if I've got the headspace to do anything else, but I'd love to. And I think the thought of collaborating with somebody else just kind of meant that the workload would be a bit shared. So we were trying to work out what we could do. And basically we decided that we didn't want to just do a website and kind of rehash information from books and studies. We wanted to make something that's going to be really practical and really, really change the dialogue within sport and sport culture. So we decided to throw an event and actually ask the audience what they wanted from us. So this is how Train Brave was born. So we came up with the name Train Brave, and we put on our first event in December. And it was a free event, which we just basically said people just needed to register, so we knew how many people would turn up. And then we put on some talks and then asked for like feedback. So when we did this, Tom and I were like, well, we'll probably get about 30 people if we're lucky. And so we had this whole kind of concept of, well, it'll be a workshop. We'll do a Q&A, and then we'll kind of, you know, break down into small groups, and we'll get some feedback and audience participation. By the time we got to November, we already had over 100 people sign up. And by the time we got to the event, we had 180 people sign up. So we were a bit like, okay, we might have to rethink what we're going to do here. And we were really, really fortunate, because London City Runners have got this amazing space down in Bermondsey, and they let us use it for free, which was fantastic. So we're doing this in the sort of, because we're passionate. So at the moment, Tom and I are a little bit out of pocket, because we're the ones who are like putting on the website. We put the website on, and we're, you know, obviously our transport costs and expenses of actually throwing the event is all coming out of our pocket. And that's fine, because that's what we wanted to do. And I guess it was the lead up to the event that created so much noise, and suddenly we had like Runners World interested in us. Fast Running did a brilliant article on us, and then Five Live got involved and said, we want to run a live event with you on the day of the event. And then I did that, and then suddenly the BBC wanted to speak to me on the news, and it was all suddenly like, wow, this is ridiculous but exciting and really full on. And you have to remember, Dina, I'd just come back from Nepal, so I was a bit like, I spent 2.5 weeks kind of completely like in the mountains, completely off grid. I didn't have my phone. And suddenly I came back and it was like, can you do this? And can you do that? And you need to go on air and you need to, and I was a bit like, whoa, this is exciting, but I'm not sure. Yeah, yeah. Really intense. And so I guess the day was really, really successful. We had a fantastic afternoon. I spoke about why people use food and training as a means of coping. And then my colleague and friend, Nikki Key, who is a phenomenal endocrinologist, she also spoke about the importance of hormones and why it can go wrong and then what the implications of that are to your health. And we had Tom and Anna Boniface and Rowan Priest, all individuals who've struggled with their own personal issues with food and training and injury. And they spoke about their stories. And So I think it was a really, really powerful event because it was a combination of personal experience and scientific kind of backing around why we have to change this. And I think for me, I left there very, very emotional because of the fact that basically so many people had come up to me afterwards and said, thank you. It was amazing. And then on the way home, on the train home, I burst into tears because I was getting all these messages from people and just saying what an amazing day it had been and how much they'd learned and how, like, some of them had, for the first time in 10 years, had gone out for a pizza with their partner. And it was the best Christmas present in the world in that respect. It was just before Christmas. And I literally was overwhelmed by the support we'd had. And I think since then, it's just grown. So it's like we've become this community that's given people strength. So obviously the last few weeks, you know, it's been that crazy time of year with the new you, new me, and all that rubbish that goes on.
Yeah, I would love to talk about that a bit more because I think that's something that, regardless of whether someone listening is thinking, okay, you know, what Rennie is saying speaks to me, or they resonated with your previous podcast or your words in other places, but everyone can kind of get sucked up into this, like you said, new year, new me kind of thing. And, you know, you've talked about how it's especially dangerous for those recovering from restrictive eating. But even those who aren't, you know, it's thankfully February now, so it's dying down a little bit, but this comes around every year. So, you know, I mean, you hear it time and time again. It's early in January, people talking about running off the excess weight. Yeah. And I'd love to hear you discuss that, kind of what mentally that does to us. You know, when people talk about, you know, these special moments with family and friends where you've made these, you know, cherished memories, enjoyed yourself. And suddenly now there's all this guilt kind of come along. And regardless of whether anyone listening is working through some kind of restrictive eating or need to work with someone, everyone feels that kind of expectation. So what would you kind of like to say to runners listening who may recognize those words within themselves?
I think, I mean, you said it really eloquently. I mean, as you know, I mean, for food for me is so much more than just fuel. And like you said, we over Christmas and everything, you kind of create these amazing memories. And then I think as soon as you, there feels like there's so much guilt around having fun these days, like you're almost not allowed to have fun. And I just think that's really unfair. And I really don't condone these messages about, well, if you know go and run 10k and burn off your, you know, mince pie or whatever it is, because I just think actually there's not an awful lot of truth in that for a start, in the sense that if we think about this very scientifically and logically, most people don't actually overeat that much over Christmas. We eat differently, right? We all eat very differently because the foods available might be different, and you might eat in a different sequence. Like you might end up eating your main meal more at lunchtime and then not wanting quite as much in the evening. But I think if we were to do the sums, you probably find that actually on average, maybe you eat a few hundred calories more a day for a few days over that period of time. That's it.
Because isn't it kind of like, if you think about the Christmas dinner, or over here it'd be more like Thanksgiving dinner, people tend to, you know, eat very little in the morning and then they'll maybe have their meal at like 2.
Yeah.
And then they don't really eat much the rest of the day. So really, instead of having 3 meals, you've kind of had 1.
Yeah, exactly. And so that's what I mean. It's like all the scaremongering that happens even before you lead up to it, you know, in terms of, so I think there was some ridiculous article that said, like, you know, the average person increases their weight by 10 pounds or something over Christmas. Well, I've never seen that. I don't know about anybody else, but I've spent time with family in the past and I've sat with them and for a week or so, and we've all eaten in different ways, and I've never seen anybody change in a week. It just doesn't happen.
Do you think any part of that, sorry, I just want to, while you're on, do you think any part of that is kind of the same thing as the, like, pregnancy, while I'm pregnant, I'm eating for two kind of thing, in that the people that maybe that would happen to are restricting so much the rest of the time that when they kind of give themselves that window, like I said, with pregnancy, where you say, I'm eating for two, where they give themselves that window, I'm going to eat whatever I want for Christmas, they go so crazy and it becomes not so much, like you said, about eating for joy or eating for memories, but literally just kind of completely you've gone off the rails.
Well, yeah, and also there's a physiological link to that, because we know that if you over-restrict your eating, if you restrict what, you know, like purposely restrict what you eat, then it affects your hormone levels, and particularly affects your leptin levels, which then send signals to the brain basically saying that, you know, you're not getting enough fuel in the system, and so it slows down your metabolic rate, and so you then don't lose the weight you think you're going to, and you restrict again, and you get in this vicious circle. But then when you do eat, when you suddenly allow yourself to eat, like you said, whether it's Christmas or pregnancy or whatever, your body is then so confused and it's kind of going, well, hang on a minute, guys, I don't know when you're going to feed me again, so I'm going to eat to excess. And so there's a physiological kind of aspect to it as well. And that's why kind of regulating your eating and listening to your internal cues is so important. And it's something that so many of us seem to have lost the ability to. So we know that when you're somebody who's in some sort of, you're in a binge restrictive cycle, or if you're somebody who does have an eating disorder and you're underweight, those people cannot listen to their hunger cues. It's impossible, because you actually don't have any at that moment in time, because your hormones are so dysregulated, which is why when you are helping somebody recover from these conditions, it's so important that you actually regulate their eating. And that's where, like, having a mechanical eating pattern is so important. And you need to maintain that for quite a long time. I mean, you've talked about this in your book as well. And it's such an important thing. You have to regulate all your hormones and your biochemistry, and you have to maintain that. It's not just a case of you get to it and then you stop. You have to maintain that. And often what I find, and I think hopefully this is what you've experienced yourself, Tina, is that once you've restored your weight, restored your metabolism, restored your biochemistry and your hormones, automatically after a period of time, those hunger cues come back in.
Absolutely.
And you don't, I mean, this whole, because at the moment, obviously, I don't know what it's like in the States, but here in the UK, there's a lot of talk about intuitive eating, and there's lots of new books out, and it's all about intuitive eating. And I don't have an issue with what intuitive eating is. It can be a fairly good intervention for some populations. And I really, really say some populations. Mm-hmm. But it's not suitable for anybody who is going through an eating disorder or recovering from any form of eating disorder, because you're basically setting yourself up to fail, because you won't be able to hear those internal cues, like I said, until you are regulated.
Yeah.
So one of the things that, you know, I always say to people is, if you look at, I mean, you can tell me about Bailey, but if you look at babies and toddlers, they know exactly what they want when they want it. They know when they're full. They know when they're hungry. They turn their heads when they've had enough milk. You know, they're very good at regulating what they need. And we're all born with that ability. But what happens is, as soon as we try and control, whether that's because we feel we have to control because of whatever, whether it's a performance-related thing or whether it's just because we believe, we kind of get sucked into this kind of thin ideal that is so big, we're actually already setting ourselves up to fail. Mm-hmm. And I guess that's it. Coming back to the whole Christmas thing, is that there's so much scaremongering. The average person, actually, at the most, if you look at the studies, the average person probably only, and this is if you really go for it, and I mean really go for it, the average person probably only puts on maybe 2 kilos.
Which is about person. 5 pounds, I think, right?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And normally, if you then go back to your normal eating behaviours, as in you just, you know, after Christmas, everybody goes back into work, so it's easy to get back into a routine of just eating your 3 meals, maybe odd snack, but, and you might start, you know, you kind of walk to work or whatever it is, just go back to normal behaviours. Actually, that just disappears, right? And the problem is we're all so obsessed, I think, with being a certain way, looking a certain way. And I think while I agree we do have a big issue with obesity, it's a very complex issue. It's not just a case of people eating too much and not having any willpower. It's a complicated psychological problem. Like eating disorders, like anorexia is, it's the same, but it's in the opposite direction. And again, they become very dysregulated from a hormonal point of view, so they can't tune into what's really going on for them. Mm-hmm. And so I think I know when I'm working with individuals, one of the biggest fears they have is, well, if I eat something just slightly different, it's almost like they believe they're going to balloon overnight and something really awful is going to happen, because it's that mindset that's kind of kicked in. And as I said to you, I mean, have you ever seen anybody balloon in front of you?
No. Unless there's some kind of, you know, health issue. Like I've seen some people who are going through some intense treatments of, you know, sickness or, you know, cancer or something like that. But yeah, otherwise, no.
No, because actually the body does work really hard for you. Like if you can listen to the internal cues, it works really hard for you. It likes to be at a place where it can work optimally. Mm-hmm. And so it actually works hard at maintaining energy balance and maintaining your weight at a place that it's happy at, which is obviously where, you know, where obviously you've got to, in terms of when you made your, you know, when you knew that you wanted things to change and you wanted to have a baby and you had to get everything back to normal. And that's kind of, you know, where you are now. And I, you know, I guess in terms of, we've had conversations before about, when you had Bailey and then you didn't want to feel that pressure of trying to get back, but actually you've just been really sensible and your body's kind of gone back to where it should be again.
Yeah. Well, and I was going to say, when you said about ballooning, I mean, I went for it. And I mean, even me, you know, I gained probably as quickly as someone could gain, as much weight as I did, about 15 pounds in, I think it was 6 or 8 weeks. But even that, you know, I wouldn't say I ballooned, and for the average person, they wouldn't have really even noticed that I gained anything. And that was me absolutely going for it. So yeah, I think that's very important that you've mentioned that. And thank you for explaining that. And also talking about what it does to our confidence, because, you know, like you said, setting yourself up to fail, we already live in this world where we feel constant pressure, like we're not doing enough. So adding this to it every year just kind of makes it worse. And at a time where a lot of people do tend to feel quite down and a bit, you know, a bit fed up at this point of year. So I want to thank you for talking about that. And just to take it one step further with regards to runners specifically, you know, many people will have like a goal race in a few months' time and they kind of feel this mad panic that they have to get down to race weight. And even if you say some people only gain, you know, up to 5 pounds or around there, or 2 kilos or what you said, there's still that pressure to be like, I've got to get down to my race weight. What would be your thoughts on that?
So I'm a big believer, and I've seen it again with the athletes I've worked with, that if you fuel your training correctly and you can put the effort in, because the problem is if you start being too restrictive because you think, I need to get down to my race weight, and you start restricting your intake, you're just not going to be able to perform. And you're going to start to actually create a deficit in your body that means potentially you're not going to get that hormonal cascade that you need in order to get the adaptation and progression. And that's something people just don't really realize, that you need to have enough energy in the system to actually get the results you're looking for.
Yeah.
So, you know, we both know that, yes, to a certain degree, if you drop a little bit of weight, you will get faster initially, maybe for 1 or 2 races, but you can't maintain that because the body doesn't want to be there. And so that's when it starts to then break down, you know, your muscles, it will start to affect your hormones, it will then potentially affect your bone health, your mood will change. And so I always say to people that if you're following a training plan and you're putting the right fuel in, and let's face it, if you're kind of like thinking, right, Christmas is out of the way now, I'm going to just get back on it, you'll find that the weight will automatically drop to where it needs to, because you don't have to go out and start being restrictive. The fact is that you probably won't be drinking quite as much. You won't be maybe eating as many mince pies or kind of chocolates that are around, mm-hmm. because your whole mentality will be different about. But what I will say is, don't force it, because it will come if you trust your body.
Absolutely agree.
I really want to just really, really want to highlight, because I've done a lot of work with Nikki Key, as I mentioned earlier, and one of the things we've done. We've done a lot of collaborative work recently where we've gone and presented, like we've presented to the England Ballet and we've presented to a lot of runners and triathletes, and really, really honed in on this. And she's the expert when it comes to hormones. But if you're not weight restored and you're not energy restored, you're not going to get this. So if you don't have enough estrogen and testosterone in your body, and particularly that happens if you don't put enough fuel in the system, then you're not going to get the IGF-1, which, you know, don't worry about the terms, but you're not going to get that level of, that's not going to be at the level it needs to be. And it's that hormone that helps you to adapt from your training. So it's that hormone that creates your muscle, lean muscle mass. It's that hormone that makes you a bit faster. You know, it's, and without the estrogen and the testosterone in the system, that's not going to happen. And that won't happen if you don't put enough, particularly carbohydrate, around those very hard training sessions. But it is generally putting enough energy in the system, full stop. And I really want to home in on that for our runners, because I know I've been getting loads of questions over the last few weeks, particularly exactly what you're just asking me around, you know, trying to drop down to a race weight and all this kind of stuff. And I've had loads of people ask me about weight and like, well, surely I'll be faster if I drop 2 kilos, but actually you'll be faster if you can hit your paces. You know, there was a good study that came out in 2016, I think it was, and it basically demonstrated that weight is only one parameter to measure when it comes to your performance. But actually, when you're looking at marathon runners in particular, it's the consistency of hitting their marathon pace in training that basically decides whether you're going to get that outcome or not. And you can only hit that marathon pace if you fuel correctly. Mm. You won't do it otherwise. I've worked with so many very, very high level marathon runners recently, and they're all in their mid to late 20s, and they've all tried to go down the road of cutting back on food to get lighter. And unfortunately, what's happened is every single one of them has ended up injured before their air race, because they just can't sustain the level of training that they need to in order to, you know, to be strong enough, basically.
Yep. Absolutely. Well, thank you for explaining that. And that's a very different way of explaining it to what we've had in the past. And, you know, I've covered this topic a few different times with you, with Nancy, with Meg and Jesse recently. And I'm glad you explained it like that, because I think that really does help to bring it home, like you said, and make it clear that, like you said, it might be okay for a few races, but in the long term, if you do really have these big goals that you want to get to, you have to fuel your body correctly. And with this, you know, this is kind of the red S thing that we're yeah. going into here. And so I wanted you to kind of explain that this is men and women, not just women. You know, women obviously know the one of the side effects being amenorrhea, which I've talked about extensively, but yeah. maybe tell us about, you know, other side effects other than ending up injured, which is something we none of us want, or ending up being able to hit your paces, as you said, which is critical to running what you want to run. But what are some other things that people will have to kind of watch out for?
So yeah, you're quite right. This affects both men and women, and obviously it's harder to sometimes diagnose in men because they don't have that monthly signal that we do. But actually one thing, I mean, I know that mainly women listen to your podcast, but one thing I would say is that what we do know is that obviously a low testosterone will mean that morning, there will be a lack of that morning erectile function that normally happens. So that is a sign for men. If there is any, if any men are listening, that is something to be aware of. Mm-hmm. But that could be a good sign that something's not right. The other thing is stomach, digestive issues. So again, I've had loads and loads of men and women come into clinic recently, and they all come in kind of presenting with this, what sounds like IBS, basically. So it sounds like irritable bowel syndrome, you know, this kind of bloating, diarrhea, constipation, flatulence type thing going on. And often it's because, again, there's just not enough energy in the system. And if there's not enough energy in the system, as I said earlier, your body will send a signal to the brain saying there's not enough energy here. We need to slow everything else down because we've got to prioritize what we can prioritize. And so things like your digestive system become very much affected. So you get delayed gastric emptying. And so that's why it doesn't matter how much fruit and vegetables you eat, you'll probably actually make the whole thing a lot worse by eating so much fruit and vegetables when you're in this place, because that already we know causes transit time to slow down, which is a good thing normally, but obviously in this case it means it slows down even more, and so it causes fermentation and bloating and discomfort. And in worst case scenario, and this is really, we're getting really like kind of quite graphic now, but in worst case scenario, what can happen is you can get so constipated and so impacted because of your slow gastric emptying that you then get something called overflow, which is when you basically get uncontrollable diarrhea that you can't, you just don't know how to deal with, because it's just because there's no room for it to be, basically. So it's not pleasant in any formal manner. And I think it's something to be very, very conscious of. If you are somebody that you kind of know you're struggling with your energy intake, you kind of know you're probably a little bit underweight, you probably know you're overdoing it, and you've got stomach issues, that's a sign not to be missed. It's a sign to actually start addressing things, definitely. So that's another big area that I see a lot of. And the other one is mood, right? So estrogen and testosterone have a huge impact on neurotransmitters in our brain, particularly the ones that produce serotonin. So if you don't have enough estrogen and testosterone flowing through your body, then again, it can really affect your mood, because we know that serotonin is so important to make us feel good. And that's, again, often why, unfortunately, we know when people have depression or they're diagnosed with depression, they have to be given antidepressants, which basically increase your uptake of serotonin. So, you know, there's a real link, and it's really important to understand that it's all connected. And I've said this before, that you can't change one area of your life and not think it's going to affect somewhere else. And I think that's what so many people do. They kind of want to sort of contain and control one area of their life because they believe it's going to make them feel better, without realizing that it actually has real lasting and negative impact on so many other areas of their health. And then the other one that we see a lot of is immune issues. So again, you might find that somebody is just constantly being, you know, just getting infections, and or again, one I've seen quite a lot recently is things like they suddenly develop like glandular fever type symptoms, or Epstein-Barr virus type symptoms, and that is a real indicator that again there's just not enough energy going in the system, and so you get like an autoimmune type response to that. So,
and I just want to clarify, so this comes regardless of weight. So, you know, you're talking to people across the board. If they, you know, have a healthy weight, women have a functioning cycle but are recognizing a lot of these symptoms, that could, you know, that doesn't rule them out because they have their cycle every month, or because their weight is quote unquote normal.
Yeah, I mean, if you've got a regular cycle, chances are you're probably okay, but you might be borderline if you're definitely seeing some of these other symptoms. So it may be that, you know, you're just about getting enough, but perhaps there's just not quite enough. What I normally find is that periods start to change quite a lot. So with women particularly, you might notice that your period gets lighter and lighter and lighter, and then it becomes less frequent. And that in itself is a sign that something's not right. The other thing I'd say is that I've even had cases where women have been on the pill, and obviously that shouldn't affect your period in that you've got an artificial, you know, withdrawal bleed going on. But I've had some women where they're so low in estrogen that even that doesn't allow them to have a period. So, you know, it's your weight is it's often not really related, if I'm honest. Like that, for some people, weight is a big indicator, but often it doesn't get affected. You can be in low energy availability, still be a normal weight, but still be affecting all these other areas of your life, definitely.
Okay, yeah. Great. Thank you for explaining that. And just one last thing about this kind of area of things. When it comes to younger runners, you know, moving forward, surely that has to be where this change comes from. You know, a lot of coaches are still in this old way of thinking that, you know, skinnier equals faster. You need to, you know, eat this food or that food. You need to make sure you're kind of not eating too much. But from what I see, particularly here in the US within the university system, but also I saw a lot of it, as I mentioned in my book that you read as well. I saw a lot of it in England when I was growing up, and I'm hoping it's changed a bit since then. But how can we, as role models for younger generations, change things to make sure that this isn't as much of an issue moving forward?
Yeah, no, absolutely. Unfortunately, I don't think it is changing that much, which is really sad. Mm. And one of the things we were hoping we hope we will do with the Train Brave campaign is that we do really want to reach out to coaches and do a lot more coach development stuff in terms of talking to coaches about communication, like how do you have those conversations, and also about creating a different environment and not always believing that lighter and skinnier is better. And I think there is a change, because there are some, I mean, I've spoken to two very good British coaches even just today, and they're people I work with regularly, and they're kind of a new wave of coaches coming through who genuinely seem to very much care about who they work with and understand that this is not the way forward. And I think the more coaches like that come through, it will change. I guess it's also important to remember that a lot of youngsters that go into running are probably a certain type of personality. So if you're a parent even of somebody who's listening to this, just being aware that those personality types does mean that they're more susceptible to potentially developing problems. So they're very, you know, they could be highly sensitive, and they'll take any sort of criticism very, very personally and beat themselves up about it. And remember that no matter what they do, they're going to feel like it's not enough. And that's where this kind of whole need to kind of keep pushing and contain emotions. And I would say that, again, trying to encourage communication and encourage a discussion and point at the good role models like yourself, Tina, and like there's some other really great role models out there. Helen Clitheroe, you know, she's a little, I think she's about my age, and she's still running amazingly well. And I know she's one of the only, you know, female GB athletes we had. I know she didn't do marathon, but who always had a regular cycle. You know, there are some really great role models out there, and I think it's about really encouraging that, and also making the youngsters aware of these other brilliant role models like yourself and you know, Anna Boniface, Bobby Clay, who've come out and really talked about their experience and what it means for them right now. Because it's not about scaremongering, it's about really explaining what is going on. And I know from my point of view, I'm doing a lot of education. I mean, I've been asked to talk at the Welsh Institute in a few weeks' time. The Scottish Institute have asked me to come and do some talks there as well to their teams and their coaches. And obviously through Train Brave, we've been asked to do a lot of work with universities. So there's a lot of demand for education, and it's about making sure we can deliver that. And I think the more we can educate people, the more podcasts we can do like this, the more books like yours that come out, and the more we can highlight this is an issue, this is not something that you want to go down, and just helping youngsters to realize that also at that age, running is, well, any age, but running is just one part of who you are. It doesn't define your worth. And I think that's the bit that always scares me, is that you get a really good youngster and they perform really well, but they're also going through a time where they will perform really well because physiologically they're at that point where they're changing lots. And while I'm not saying coaches shouldn't encourage, but I think they should also encourage them to do lots of other things as well and not just focus on one aspect of who they are. There's lots to be done. It is changing very, very slowly. And I think there does seem to be movement across the UK and the US, but it's slow, sadly. Yeah.
And one more thing related to that. So just on an individual one-on-one basis, someone listening right now, you know, they're not a quote-unquote influencer, they're not going to be a speaker, they're not anything like that, but maybe they have, you know, a niece or a nephew for that matter, or a son or a daughter, or just some younger athlete that they know in their life and maybe looks up to them, or even with the running, or even just in a general sense. How important is it the way we talk to ourselves? Like if you kind of say, oh my God, I look too fat today to wear this, or oh God, I need to lose weight, I need to stop being a pig and eating all the pies or whatever. Like how important is the way that we speak to ourselves in front of them? Is that affecting them too?
Oh my God, absolutely, 100%. It not only affects them, but it affects us too. I mean, the language we use for ourselves and the language we use in front of other people has a big, big influence. I mean, there's a lot of work in this area. Like there's a lot of research in this area. And I, you know, some of the therapists I work with, they've spoken to me about language, and like I've gone to them and asked them, you know, how do I need to be careful about what I say? So some of the things I talk about are things like, I never talk about weight gain. I always talk about weight restoration. You know, because it's important for them to realize that they are not, they're not, we're not asking them to gain weight, we're asking them to weight restore, which is really, really important.
I love that.
And I always talk about, we all have intrusive thoughts on a daily basis. We all have thoughts that make us feel uncomfortable and not particularly great. But actually, for every intrusive thought, you know, can you find an opposing best friend thought? So, which are the thoughts that have got your best interest at heart? You know, like we could all sit there and say, oh, I should be doing this and I could be doing better. Or you know, you should never have to say you should, you know, it's about kind of accepting that sometimes we don't have a good day, but that doesn't define us. That doesn't mean that we're a bad person. You shouldn't be defined by what's going on around you. You've got to remember who you are fundamentally. So I think definitely, you know, parents, aunts, uncles, whatever, they should not, you know, never ever kind of be negative about yourself. I mean, okay, you might be uncomfortable in your body for whatever reason, but actually even that I would question, you know, why are you making it such a big deal? Because it's only because you're trying to live up to those, what we believe is society's ideals. But we also know that being a certain weight does not necessarily make us happier. It's not going to change who we are. It doesn't fundamentally change who you are from inside. You've got to get to the point where you're actually okay with being you. I mean, it's not quite the same, but I know that some of you will know, and I know, Tina, you know, but obviously I got divorced a year ago, and it's taken me a long time to get used to being on my own again, because I was married for 15 years and with someone for 17 years. So it was a long, long, big part of my adult life. And I remember thinking, I don't like this. I don't want to be on my own. I don't enjoy it. I don't, you know, it's a weird place to be. But through working on myself and through kind of spending time with myself and rebuilding that relationship with myself, I'm now at a point where I'm actually really comfortable with being on my own. And I think it's an interesting thing, because as soon as you're comfortable with it, it doesn't feel fearful anymore.
Yes.
And it doesn't, you know, you kind of just relax about it. And I'm not saying I want to be on my own forever, but I'm comfortable with it. And I think it's the same sort of thing. You have to be comfortable with who you are. And if you get to that point, you will probably perform and do really well, because you're not really worried. You're managing your expectations, I guess, a bit better from that point of view.
Absolutely. Could not agree more. And it's funny, I got interviewed this morning for a publication, and they kind of asked me about my like relationship with food now. And I was like, I just don't really put that much thought into it. Like, you know, I often get asked about what's a day of eating for you? And I'm like, I honestly don't know, because like once it goes in, like, I'm like, what do I want to eat? I want to have, you know, a grilled cheese sandwich. Okay. I eat the grilled cheese and then it's gone. Like and it's exactly what you just said. It's a place where you're comfortable with it, and you just kind of, it is what it is. And yeah, like you said, some days might be good, some days might be bad, but you just don't put that much thought into it anymore. So I'm so glad you said that, because I think that is important. And just for someone listening, if you are listening and you're thinking, okay, that's all well and good, but how do I get there? I would definitely recommend going back to the Meg and Jesse episode, which was episode 94, I believe. I'm just looking. 89. So episode 89, go back to that one. That's more specific advice on how to, but unfortunately, as much as you may not want to hear this, a lot of it comes down to working with an expert like Rennie or like Meg or Jesse or Nancy. You may have to go to that stage if you do recognize that within yourself. But thank you for explaining that there. And just one more thing before we take a break to thank our sponsor and get on with the Running for Real 4. You mentioned a few times that you have read my book. I would love to hear any thoughts that you had. I mean, I got a quick message from you after you read it. and it's quite different to your book. It's quite different to Nancy's book or any of the other No Period Now What kind of thing. But I'd love to hear just kind of, or tell the audience that it's not coming from me with a bias, what your thoughts were and who you think this is going to be good for.
So I'll be honest, I'm usually really skeptical of books that are personal journeys, because I think while it does help some people to read about a personal experience, especially if they're going through it, it can often be quite biased and sometimes not as helpful. And in some cases, I think it can even set up almost like it can be quite triggering. And I have had individuals that have come into clinic and said, oh, I read this book and it's just, you know, it's almost like set up a competition. I want to be worse than this person, which sounds ridiculous, but obviously the eating disorder mindset is very irrational, as we know. What I loved about your book, Tina, is one, it's really, really, really lovely to read. Like you just got a really nice style, which I really like. And I think it's because I like chatting to you anyway. It's like I was just having a conversation with you. And it's like, the thing also I liked about it is you're very similar to me in that you're giving people permission, which is what a lot of people want. They want permission to change. Mm-hmm. And I really like that. That was kind of really all the way through. I found like, yeah, this is lovely. This is exactly what people need to hear. But also what I think is great is that you, while it's not like my book is very scientific because I'm a scientist and that's what I do. And it's very practitioner based, but in a style, hopefully that makes it quite practical. With your book, it's like you haven't just said, look, this is what I think, guys. You've talked about your experience of working with experts. You've talked about the research you've done, and you've talked about how it got you to the point where you are now, in that, you know, you did find it difficult and you're really honest about how frightening sometimes it was and how uncomfortable you felt, but you did it. And that's the thing I always say to people when they're trying to do what you've done, is that it's not easy, and you're not going to suddenly have a light bulb moment where it's going to suddenly feel all okay. You know, you're going to have to accept that it's an uncomfortable experience, mm-hmm. but it will pass, like any anxiety, like anything. Yeah. You have to learn that. I mean, like, you know, being a mum, right? It's hard work, and you never know whether you're doing it right or wrong. And then sometimes the anxiety is really acute, but you just have to sit with it and know that actually it'll be okay. It will be okay. You will feel better. And it's the same thing when you're recovering from, when you need to weight restore and when you're recovering from an eating disorder, it's not a comfortable process, because you're basically going against everything that you have followed for so long. But it's knowing that actually that discomfort is progress, in the same way as, you know, training was progress for you when you pushed yourself. It's the same sort of thing. And so, yeah, I thought your book was brilliant. I loved it. I found it very easy. I mean, I you sent it to me and I needed to find a window, and I literally read it in 2 days. It was really great. So yeah, thank you. And I think it will help lots of people. And just again, just highlighting how it's not okay to not have a period. You know, it's not okay. And I think the fact that also just giving people hope, because I think that's the biggest thing, is that I get lots of youngsters who haven't had periods for a long time, like yourself, and they're like, will I ever get it back? And will I ever be able to have children? And I can't give anybody any certainty, but I think what I do know is that if you've had periods in the past and you weight restore, periods do come back, you sometimes have to go above where you want to be, because that's the other thing, isn't it? Like, everybody wants to be the lowest possible BMI they can be to have a period. But actually, in some cases, depending on your body type and your genetics, you might have to be a little bit more. You might have to have a BMI of 21, 22. You know, that's just how your body is. But you can definitely be successful and have, you know, have periods, and then, like you've shown, have a baby and you know, be okay and be comfortable. And I think, I mean, I've said this to you personally, but I genuinely love what a great role model you have been to
so sweet.
And I do mean that, but also, like, the conversation we had a few months ago where it was just you and me talking, and, you know, like I said to you, I'm so proud of the fact that you didn't rush to try and get back to running as quickly as possible. And, you know, Bailey was so important to you, and spending time with her was such an important aspect of becoming a mum, that you didn't suddenly think, oh, I've got to go and get my 5-10K in or whatever. You did it in a way that's been comfortable for you. You've listened to your body. You've done it in a really positive way. And I feel like people should really learn from that as well. So yeah, the book's great, but yeah, I think generally your message and how, and what you do is really positive as well.
Thank you so much. That's so kind of you to say. And I really appreciate that. And it has been nice for me seeing that, like you said, I have kind of become that source of hope, particularly having got my period back now after Bailey while still breastfeeding. I mean, that for me was another huge win. And then having my race this weekend was another one, just kind of showing that you can run well afterwards. So it has been nice for me to see, you know, it come full circle. And thank you so much for the sweet words and the nice words about the book as well. And to anyone listening, Overcoming Amenorrhea is available on Amazon, so you can go find it there, and hopefully you will enjoy it too. So Rennie, we are going to take a moment to thank our sponsors, and we'll be back with the Running for Real 4.
Guess what, my friends? My book on overcoming amenorrhea is out in the world, and I'm so excited that you've been on this journey with me. And had it not been for your support and encouragement, I'm not sure I would have had the courage to do it. Working on getting your period back is not easy, but even if you're not working through that, finding confidence in your body is, I would say, sometimes even harder, and that's something that almost everyone struggles with. And that's actually what this book is focused on. If you're trying to get your period back, this is the ideal book to support you. But even if you're not, and you can spare a few dollars, your support through purchasing the book shows me just how thankful you are. And I'm trying to make it a bestseller. Your purchase could help get me there. I know you feel like you're only one person. What does one person matter? But it really does. It all adds up. It is available on both Kindle and paperback. And I know I love a physical copy in my hands, and I hope if you do too, you'll get yourself one and take a picture of you holding the book. That makes me so happy. And you can find out more by searching on Amazon for my name, Tina Muir. That's T-I-N-A-M-U-I-R, which is a heck of a lot easier than trying to spell amenorrhea. I don't know how many of you have tried to write out that word. It took me quite a long time to get that down, but I promise you my name is a little bit easier. You can also find a link to it. It will go directly there by going to tinamuir.com/book. And if you are not an Amazon person, you can also find the book on my website under the products section. Thank you so much. Let's get back to the episode.
All right. Four more questions for you, starting with one piece of advice you would like to give the listeners for life.
Oh, wow. One piece of advice to give to the listeners, I would say just don't beat yourself up about anything. It's not worth it. Like, you know, like, I think, I mean, probably because I'm a bit older now, but if I look back at myself 10 years ago, I wish I'd just been kinder. Yeah. I really do.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that. And that's one thing I know that I've been working on, and a lot of people listening are working on. Not easy to do, but so true. And thank you for that. All right. One person to follow on social media and why?
So that's really tough, but I have been thinking about this, and I guess the person I'm going to say is actually, he's another nutritionist. And the reason I'm going to say him is because he talks so much sense. So his name is The Nutritional Advocate, and he's Alan Flanagan. And I think he is awesome. And I don't often give that many other nutritionists a big shout out, but I've spent time with Alan as well, and I just really like what he does. He just makes the science really, really easily accessible and really just puts the facts as they are. So I think he's great. So I'd say give him a follow.
Okay, cool. I will definitely put links in the show notes to him and all the things we've talked about today, by the way, while we have the moment. Train Brave, Rennie's book, all the other links we've mentioned will be in there. All right, Rennie, how would you like to be remembered as a guest on this show?
I always hope that I give people the sense that I really do genuinely care.
You do.
I care about everybody I work with, and I just want people to be kind to themselves and realize that life is so much more than a number or what you eat. I hope people can really feel my compassion, because that's what I'd like to be remembered as.
Definitely comes across. So you are definitely fulfilling that one. And finally, what do you tell yourself? I may have asked you this last year, but I'd love to hear if it's changed at all. Before you're going on to do a presentation or some kind of event, what do you tell yourself?
I usually tell myself it'll be over in an hour, so don't stress.
In an hour, you can be drinking a cocktail.
Yeah, exactly. Generally speaking, that is kind of what I tell myself. I don't like present. Like when I had to do the news recently, it was this kind of right, just deep breath. It's going to be okay. Mm-hmm. It'll all be over very soon. But I guess the thing is, generally speaking, once I start, I'm fairly comfortable with the topic I'm talking about. So it's okay.
Okay, great. All right. And where can people find out more about you if they would like to follow along?
So I have a website, which is reniemcgregor.com. Most of my social media is actually on my Instagram account, which is r_McGregor. I'm also running the Train Brave account, which is train_Brave. And I'm on Twitter as McGregor_Reni.
Okay. All right. I'll put links to those in the show notes. Thank you so much for all the wisdom, for the kind words, and just for being here today. I appreciate you so much, my friend. And I'm sure the listeners have loved it too.
Oh, it's been great to be back. And we're always really great to chat to you, Tina. So good luck with the book.
Thank you. My friends, if you have a minute and you could leave a review on your favorite podcast player, Apple Podcasts, aka iTunes, Stitcher, Overcast, Pocket Cast, Spotify, or whatever else podcast player you use to listen to this podcast, or if you would subscribe to this podcast, you will help me get out in front of new runners to make our tribe even bigger and even better. It might not seem like you as one person can make a difference, but really it helps a lot. And it shows me you appreciate the hard work I put in for those. Thank you so much. I know we've covered nutrition a lot lately, but it's something everyone seems to be very confused about. Even after I created that nutrition podcast series, I feel like in a lot of ways I confused people more than I helped. So I'm hoping these experts I bring on are helping you to see that there isn't any real secret, no diet that specifically works. It's just the basics and learning to love your body no matter what you eat. Remember, my book on overcoming amenorrhea is out now. So if you're trying to get your period back, this contains everything I did and recommend to give yourself the best chance of getting it back and quickly. Obviously, everyone is different, but I think you'll find my advice very helpful. And if you aren't working through getting your period back, but you do struggle with body image, this book has a lot about that too. You can get yourself a copy by searching my name on Amazon, as amenorrhea is not an easy word to spell, or by going to tinamuir.com/book. For those of you who have already read the book, I should say, if you enjoy it, could you do me a huge favor? Well, actually, one of two favors, really. You can do one of two of two, but hopefully one of them at least. Could you take a photo of yourself with the book and share it on your social media? It means so much to me. You put the hugest smile on my face every time I see one of those, especially if you tag me in it. I may not see it if you don't. And two, if you could leave a review on Amazon on the book, that means so much. And we all know how much those reviews mean to us when we're making a decision. So you really could be helping someone else in the future who is struggling with this and wondering what they should do about it. If they see lots of positive reviews, they're more likely to get it. And then that's another friend that we all have as a member of this community. There are links to the book and everything else we talked about today in the show notes at tinamuir.com/episode99. So speaking of that, episode 99, that means next week is episode 100. And I have a special episode for you, where I am being interviewed about this podcast, how far it's come, and winning the Disney race.
You loved my interview, the interviewer I had, Sarah Crouch, before, and so I thought I would bring her back. I thought about making, you know, episode 100 a big name guest, someone that would be really explosive, but then so many other podcasts have done something similar to that, and they've all had these guests, and you know, you hear the same names over and over again, and I like being quite different. And this is Running for Real, so I thought, why not just have fun? You can come join me next week for my 100th episode with Sarah Crouch. I'm sure you're going to enjoy it. I hope you have a great week.
Thanks for listening to the Running for Real podcast. Be sure to check out tinamuir.com for show notes and even more helpful running information.